just as the mass of the snow beneath the blows of the warm rays is stripped of both its former color and its cold, so is your mind left bare of error. I would offer now to you a new form, light so living that it trembles in your sight. These are some words by Dante Alighieri in his 14th century poem, The Paradiso. Dante's Paradiso has some beautiful images of fish swimming in pools, of sunlight reflecting off the snow, and of light being filtered through colored glass. All of these beautiful images are metaphors, and it's the power of these metaphors that has made Dante stand the test of time. Today in this lecture for East and West Learning Connections, I'll talk about who Dante was and why he was important in European literature. I'll talk about the Paradiso specifically. East and West Learning Connections lectures and meetings are a great way for newcomers to Canada to learn about Canadian culture and practice their English, and I'm honored to be a part of their programming. Dante was a medieval Italian writer, and he's extremely famous today. He influenced a number of English writers and writers in other languages as well. He influenced Chaucer, who in turn influenced Shakespeare and Milton and Spencer, and lots of 20th century writers too. Dante was influential in terms of religious imagery, and as I pointed out in past lectures, religious imagery had a major effect on all kinds of literary, artistic, and musical imagery over the centuries. Now, I'm aware that most people today who live in Canada are not practicing Catholics. The fact is, though, that literary imagery and our views on life are still to some extent conditioned by values that live in the person, in the generation, and that gets passed down to children. So if someone stops going to church, they may still have values that they had when they were given to them as children, and they may still be shaped by these ideas and imagery that was shaped them when they were kids. For example, one person I know recently described himself as someone who's not Christian, but respects Christian culture. He doesn't believe in God, but he's very familiar with Christian ideals and imagery. And other people might say, you know, they don't believe that Jesus died for their sins, but they like Christmas and they like Christian imagery. It appeals to them. And to me, what that means is that Christian culture is still out there, but it's no longer viewed as Christian per se. And I think that's where we might begin with Dante. I would say his images are wonderful because they help us appreciate the natural world that we live in. And I think that world is quite miraculous and beautiful, and poetry can help us pay more attention to it and appreciate it, which is really not what Dante would want me to say. Dante would want me to say that these images glorify God. Of course, I can't say that because I don't believe in God. So who was Dante? Well, he was a city official in Florence, the city of Florence in Italy. At that time, Italy was divided into city-states, and the city of Florence was quite powerful, and Dante was a key figure. But there was a political conflict within the city between the white and the black Guelphs. In fact, the city of Guelph is named after this same group. So Dante belonged to the white Guelphs, but the black Guelphs won, and so they exiled him from the city. In fact, they charged him a big fine, money, but they also confiscated all of his assets. So he was unable to pay the fine, and he had to leave. He died in Ravenna. He never went back to Florence. And while he was in exile, he wrote his very famous Divine Comedy. Now, if we want to make an analogy between what happened to Dante and something today, we could maybe look at what happens in other places where rivalries mean that people are exiled or stripped of their assets today. For example, in Saudi Arabia, it's run by a very rich family, and if there are various conflicts within the family, one prince might take all of the money away from someone and then exile them or imprison them. Specifically, I've just begun reading the book Blood and Oil, which is about the rise of Mohammed bin Salman, so that's why that is on my mind. So Dante was a political official, he was also a writer, and he was exiled, and that gave him time to write his poem. It was a very long poem. The Paradiso has 33 chapters, which are called cantos, and there were three volumes of the comedy. There was the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and the Paradiso. So I myself have read the Inferno and the Paradiso, and I confess I have not read the Purgatory. So I guess I'm going to be spending longer in purgatory unless I go and read it. It's not very common for people to read Dante these days in their English literature university education, but I'd say about 50 years ago, it would have been required or, you know, really appreciated if you took a liberal arts degree. These days, in order to read the Paradiso, you would probably take a course that focuses on influences on Western literature and culture, if not actual Italian. So what's the basic concept of the Paradiso and how does it work?
Well, paradise is heaven, and the Paradiso, the book, is about Dante's journey through different sections of heaven. So heaven is imagined to have nine sections, nine celestial spheres, and they're all named after the planets. Dante, the poet, travels through those parts of the sphere. He goes through the seven lower parts, and then he goes through the two higher parts. And along the way, he talks to various famous saints and holy men, including St. John and Thomas Aquinas. Because he's traveling in heaven, the Paradiso is much more about theology than Dante's Inferno is. In fact, a lot of the Paradiso is about how difficult it is for Dante as a human being to perceive things that are beyond his capabilities. What I mean is, we have this idea that a human being is not capable of understanding divine ideas, which are bigger than the human mind and more complex and just more difficult. God has amazing abilities, and we humans cannot receive those abilities. In a lecture on the Book of John a few months ago, I talked about how there's an emphasis on mystery in Christianity. And what I mean is that there's different kinds of knowledge, and love and God are kind of beyond the ability of the normal human mind to grasp. Love and God, those things require faith. And this is a kind of model of knowledge that is anti-intellectual. And in the Paradiso, we get this too, but Dante really spells it out. He says that he as a human being is really incapable of perceiving things sometimes, and he just has to have them explained for him by his guide, who is named Beatrice.
So the Paradiso isn't really anti-intellectual in the same way, because Dante is explaining how we can understand the mind of God if we just try. So the figure of Beatrice, who is Dante's guide, she's pretty important. She's a human woman who appears to have actually existed in Dante the poet's real life. Dante did not marry her, and he seems to have only met her twice, but he seems to have been in love with her all of his life. In the Paradiso, Beatrice is a mystical figure who leads him towards God. She's the personification of grace and the personification of divine revelation and theology. So when I say personification, this means using a person as a metaphor for a concept. So for example, if you say that this woman Jane personifies loyalty, and then Jane runs away from you, then we would say that loyalty has run away. In other words, I feel like there is no loyalty anymore. It's quite common to have personified women who are guides in medieval manuscripts, medieval poetry. Boethius, for example, has Lady Philosophy as a guide in the book The Consolation of Philosophy. In the Paradiso, Beatrice is a messenger of God. So the main thing we need to remember about Beatrice is she's not a person, she represents a concept. So Dante portrays himself as knowing nothing, and if we want to boil it down to something very simple, we would say that Dante is stupid and Beatrice is smart. Dante keeps making stupid mistakes about what he sees and what that means. Now, the figure of Dante represents your average human person who is pretty stupid and cannot grasp the importance and meaning of God. So once again, I'm going to stop here and say, let's imagine you are not Christian. So what does that mean? How can we put that in a non-Christian context? Let's think about the idea of ego. If you have a big ego, you're someone who believes that you know everything and you've solved all those issues and you're a great person. But if you go through life having a big ego, this is viewed as a problem and distasteful to other people. So instead of acting like someone who is very accomplished or knowledgeable, it's much more socially acceptable to go around in our culture and convey to people that we don't know things. In other words, modesty is really valued very highly in our culture. But that's not true in all cultures. In some cultures, there's a culture of bragging and boasting. In ancient Greece, for example, it was acceptable and expected to brag about all your great accomplishments if you were a soldier. And still in our society, there are some people who think they need to draw attention to their greatness, the size of the fish they caught, or the difficulty of the surgery they carried out, the race that they won. They need to brag about how fast or strong they are. Of course, there are some gender differences here. It seems much more socially acceptable for men to brag than for women to brag. And that's why women often hide their accomplishments and try not to boast. Anyway, if we look at the figure of Dante, he portrays himself as being very modest, which is ironic because Dante, the writer, does know a lot. Now, I do think the only way you can go about learning things in life is by admitting that you don't know things to begin with. And so I think this idea of modesty and not knowing things is actually necessary for really advanced learning. So, for example, if I think about my friends who have PhDs, I would say one thing they have in common is that they're very curious about the world, and they want to continue learning, and they believe they know very little in comparison to other people. And so, coming back to this idea of learning about God's truth, this idea that you have to accept that you don't know everything, this attitude transfers quite well to our modern atheist life, in which we go about accepting that we're not perfect, and we need to always be learning more. There is a questioning in Dante's work, an intellectual curiosity that I think is very useful for us. And so when I read the Paradiso and I'm confronted with the figure of Dante, who seems to be most of the time pretty much an idiot about what is happening all around him, I find that really appealing and amusing and kind of cute. It's a little bit childlike, and I like that innocence. I feel like that kind of innocence is a valuable thing to cultivate in our life, and we want to go about being surprised by the beautiful things that we see in our world. It's not nice to be jaded. It's nice to be continually surprised and find out wonderful things. That's why I read and try to learn all the time. I suppose the problem with my point here is that Dante's figure of childlike stupidity is just a metaphor. It's not real. The figure of Dante as lacking in knowledge, it's a fiction. This is a narrative figure. Dante in the poem is not a real person. This is Dante the narrator. It's not Dante the author. Before I start talking about Canto 1, I'll just say, in terms of the Paradiso story, there's not really a story. And I don't find whatever story there is particularly interesting. That's not why I read this poem. I read it for the imagery and the poetry. I'm happy just to pick it up and open it at really any particular spot and read that section. So I wouldn't normally read it from beginning to end. I don't know if I would recommend that. But let's talk about Canto 1. So in Canto 1, Dante says God's glory is reflected more in one part of the world and less in another part. So glory from God is like a sun that shines out into the world, and part of the world reflects some of his glory back, and part of the world reflects more of the glory back. And this, to me, reminds me of the book Corinthians in the Bible. I mentioned that in a previous lecture. So in Corinthians, Paul says, quote, "We know in part and we prophesy in part, but later we shall fully see." And what he means is that the knowledge of God is limited by our human nature. This imagery that Dante uses is consistent with what Paul says, I think, and it's also consistent with the image of a medieval stained glass window. So if we can imagine the stained glass window, some of the window reflects the light better than other parts, because one part of the window is brighter than the other part. The stained glass image also appears in Canto 2, and Dante says, "From there, the rays of the sun would be thrown back, just as from glass that hides lead at its back, a ray of colored light returns, reflected." This is the stained glass image again. So here Dante begins to talk about mirrors that reflect in each other. And a little later he expands on the image, so it's clear that God's influence on the mind is not only like light on glass, but also on snow. So the light falls on the snow and warms it and melts it. And he says in the Canto 2, "Just as the mass of the snow beneath the blows of the warm rays is stripped of both its former color and its cold, so is your mind left bare of error. I would offer now to you a new form. Light so living that it trembles in your sight." Here the mind is melted into liquid when the light of God's mind falls upon it. If we're to think about this in a non-religious context, think about it as if your mind were cleansed and melted, like water forming on snow, when the light of understanding falls upon it. So this is a beautiful image, and if you want to take it out of the religious context again, think about the light as a creative power, because that's how Dante thinks of God. He thinks of God as a creative power. So you probably believe in the power of the mind, the power of the mind to be creative. So if you think about your own powers of creation, some activities, some things in the world reflect your creative abilities better than other activities do. Some areas of the world are more accessible to your mind than other areas of the world are. You're able to learn more about some things rather than other things because of the way your mind is structured uniquely. So basically, the light of understanding helps us to see certain areas better than other areas in our lives. So the light that shines through the stained glass window, that light represents the power of God's mind. And of course, God's mind is modeled on the human mind. So we're learning about minds in general and their creative powers. So what happens when you have misleading ideas or wrong ideas? Well, in the first 100 lines of Canto 1, Dante describes what happens when humans are freed from their misleading ideas. So humans are viewed as having these misleading ideas that imprison their mind, but when their minds are freed, we can release a lot of energy. So let's look at some of the images related to that energy. If we look at line 34, Dante says, "A minute spark precedes a towering flame." Of course, he's talking about how a spark can set on fire a large bonfire. Imagine that you've gone camping and you're trying to light a fire and you take your match and throw it in the fire and it lights everything up. Or you might also think of the wildfires that are started by electric sparks from our overloaded electrical power grids. This is also the same image. A small spark leads to a big fire. So what is fire? Well, it's energy. And what is a spark? It's a little bit of energy too. And so that's what Dante is saying. A lot of energy can be released once you free your mind. Of course, the energy that Dante is talking about comes from God. But the basic idea that you can free your mind and then become so much more productive and full of energy, this is a very persuasive and engaging idea. How wonderful it would be to be full of energy. And if you've ever had some striking insight and then your life changed as a result, you've been filled with energy and able to do new things, that's the kind of experience Dante is thinking about. And in some ways, of course, this is religious conversion imagery. You're on fire with love for God. So even though we don't really experience religious conversion anymore very commonly, we do experience inspirational life changes. And so that's how I see that as relevant to us today. If we look at lines 46 through 61, there's some really beautiful imagery that combines birds flying with the sun and the sparks. So in line 46, Dante says that Beatrice turned and looked left, so she set her eyes at the sun. So Beatrice looks at the sun, and Dante compares her to an eagle. He says, "There's no eagle so intent." And then he describes another bird, a falcon. And he says, "Like a falcon will dive down and then strike back up, so too Beatrice makes Dante look down and then up directly at the sun." The imagery of birds reaching towards the sun is pretty significant for Dante throughout the whole Paradiso. In Canto 18, Dante compares the souls of good people to birds flying in search of food. And it's not just that the soul of the good person is ultimately trying to get back to God. This is an Aristotelian conception of the purpose of the soul, the idea that the soul is always reaching back to its perfect origin. And it's also about the pursuit of justice. The place of human beings is to seek justice. And the natural order of things is for a human being to try to act in a good way. So flying is an activity, and just like a bird naturally flies, it's the natural order of things in the universe. So too, a human being pursues justice naturally and pursues the good life naturally. And if we look at Canto 18 right now, we can have a closer look at this imagery of birds again, this imagery of looking at the sun. So at the start of Canto 18, Dante says, "My soul was free from any other need, as long as the eternal loveliness that shone on Beatrice directly from her eyes contacted me with reflected light." So here we have the same imagery of light being reflected, seeing things. It's very important to look and to have light to see things. And in line 25, he says, "In the flaming of the holy fire to which I turned, I saw that he desired some further words with me." So again, we have this idea of fire and things associated with fire. And next in line 36, Dante is looking at a cross and there's a lightning flash. So once again, there's a symmetry of fire and lightning flashing being associated with learning something. a kind of light and energy. And what he means is that you have a small amount of curiosity, and if you turn your mind in the right direction, later on, it will yield great energy and great results. So this is a very hopeful image, right? If you just take one step in the right direction toward knowledge, you will eventually receive this wonderful reward of vibrant energy. So in line 73 of Canto 18, we have birds again. And here Dante is comparing birds to saintly beings who are providing him with a special divine message. The letters D and I and L represent the first letters of the Latin phrase Dilegitate Justitiam qui judicatis terram, which basically means love justice, you rulers of the earth. So we're getting back to an interest in law and justice. Now, you know Dante himself was a politician, I mentioned that at the beginning, and the pursuit of justice is considered to be an important aspect of living the good life. A few lectures ago, I talked about justice being the theme of Sophocles' play in Oedipus. It's important to live the good life, a just life. And so that is what Dante is saying also. Live the good life, live the just life. So in other words, humans should live in a good manner and do the right thing. So in this imagery, the birds themselves are forming the letters of the message. Well, who are the birds? The birds represent human souls. So the human souls themselves are performing justice. They are forming the words that mean justice. They're shaping their bodies and their behavior in a way that is just and good, flying towards the sun or flying to get food. This is proper and normal behavior. It's just justice behavior. And let's look at the emphasis on the message as a set of words, too. So the metaphor is skywriting, writing in the sky. Divine knowledge is a set of written words, words that you see written on the sky, and the good life is associated with writing something down. Writing, of course, is a kind of learning. So you probably believe that knowledge is related to writing and learning, too. These are virtuous, good activities. So Dante's point is that just like the birds naturally fly to seek their food, so also do good people act in just and fair ways and learn things and read and write. And so this is also the point of a Victorian sonnet written by the English poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. And he's writing about kingfishers, the kingfisher bird catching fire. And that seems like a very appropriate connection to Dante. So the idea in Hopkins' poem is that the bird appears to catch fire because it flies so fast and is so colorful and it sparkles in the light. And dragonflies do the same. So how beautiful is this imagery of birds appearing to catch fire? And also it reminds me of the Hunger Games, but anyways. So how appropriate is that in terms of showing us the energy that can happen when a person is doing the right thing? Again, once you turn toward the right purpose, you light on fire. You gain all of this energy and you make things happen. And of course, when I think of this fire energy, I also think of more pop culture, the John Legend song, Let's Start a Fire. And that's a romantic song, but you know, the fact is that all the romantic imagery that we encounter has been shaped over time by religious imagery, which looks at the relationship between God and humans as a kind of fire of passion. So in other words, we're talking about romantic passion today by using language that is conditioned by 800 years of religious imagery that saw God's love as a model for human love. The fire of love. It's a very ancient image. And going back to this idea of fire, we see that in Canto 18, as well as in line 100, he talks about the sparks rising up and striking logs. So basically, this is the imagery of tinder. So I don't know about you, but I find this language very beautiful, even in translation from 700 years ago. Sparks, burning logs, a thousand lights, the sun kindling the warmth in our hearts. It's very lovely. And I'm reminded of Aristotle's idea that poetry is good when it imitates good things. Somehow Dante is able to evoke for us something beautiful that exists in his time and in ours, and we make a connection with someone who is hundreds of years older than us. So I've talked about bird and fire imagery. I want to talk about musical imagery now. So lines 76 to 84 of Canto 1 say that God draws Dante's attention with both fire and music. He says, "The newness of the sound and the great light incited me to learn their cause." So this line captures several important points about the Paradiso. First, the light of God, or understanding, will make Dante learn their cause. And God is the cause of everything, right? God is the prime mover. He's the main cause, the first cause. So we've discussed this imagery of light and fire. Light is drawn down to the world and reflected back. light also is connected to sparks, which then light a fire of passion to love God and to learn more about God. But there's something else here that draws Dante's attention, and that's the newness of the sound. He says, the newness of the sound and the great light incited me to learn their cause. So a few lines earlier, Dante has mentioned that the wheel of the heavens creates a harmony that draws Dante's attention. He says, when that wheel, which you make eternal through the heavens longing for you, drew me with the harmony you temper and distinguish, etc., etc., he's saying that the music of the spheres has drawn his attention to God. So the sound or harmony, this divine sound, is drawing our attention back to God, back to the cause of the sound. And it's the movement of the planets that's really important here. That movement, the movement of the planets, is a metaphor for the movement of the soul back to God. So again, we could take this out of a Christian context. The movement of the planets is a metaphor for the human's movement toward perfection, toward improvement. We're all trying to change ourselves into better people. And that drive towards self-improvement, that's what Dante is talking about. We're trying to get better. We're moving toward a better place. And the movement of the planets is the metaphor for that movement. So the main insight here that Dante is trying to give us is that movement is basically orderly and natural. There's a divine order controlling our movements and making sure we get back to him. Dante believes in destiny. So you may also believe in destiny. I'm always surprised at how many people believe in fate, although they don't believe in God. But the idea of fate is actually older than Christianity. So going back to Dante's metaphors of sound and music, he's trying also to explain why sometimes humans do not do the good thing. Sometimes humans do the wrong thing. And why is that? If they're always trying to get towards God, toward a better version of themselves, why do they make so many mistakes? Now he says in Canto 1, it's true, even as a shape may not accord with art's intent, since matter may be unresponsive or deaf, so from this course the creature strays at times because he has the power, once impelled, to swerve elsewhere, as lightning from a cloud. So what he's saying is that we go off course. People go off course. So why do we go off course? Well, we're drawn away from the good goal by false pleasure, he says. In other words, we're attracted to the wrong thing, something sinful or bad. Someone does the wrong thing, someone swerves off course. And that's because, he says, quote, matter may be deaf. So matter, or things, people, worldly things, cannot necessarily hear the divine music. This divine music from God, the music of the spheres, it's like a memo from God, or instructions from God. It tells us what to do, and yet sometimes we're deaf. We don't hear. We can't hear. So we're deaf to God's music. And so taking this out of a Christian context again, well, humans are designed to do the right thing, but sometimes we don't get the right guide. We don't get the right training, the right instructions. Sometimes we're unresponsive to the commands that come to us. If you want to think about the parent-child relationship, sometimes children don't do what the parents tell them, even though it's the right thing to do. So it's a paternalistic metaphor, right? It's a paternalistic view of human nature, but it's also kind of comforting. Like somehow it's not our fault, you know? Like if we mess up, it's because we missed the memo. We missed the music. But even though we missed the lesson, Dante wants to make us hopeful nevertheless. So he reminds us that even if we missed the memo, there's something within us that still wants to do good. We just have to turn toward the good thing and try to get back to the cause, the thing for which humans were designed. So if we look at the final canto, he repeats the point that humans desire for the good. This is in Canto 33, the last canto of the Paradiso. He says, quote, for good, the only object of our will is gathered up entire into that one light. So he's pointing out again that good is the right goal for humans. Good is the object of our will. Will means desire. And if things go in the right way, humans should always be aiming at the good. And this is how Dante finishes the poem too. He says he was turned in the right direction. He says, now my will and my desire were turned as wheels that move in equilibrium by love that moves the sun and other stars. And when he says wheels, he's talking about the planets again, moving in a circle. When he says equilibrium, Dante is talking about things being in balance. Of course, Dante did not know what we know about what kept the planets in order. He didn't know about gravity or how that worked, but he does know the science that's available to him at the time, and there were various theories of why the planets stayed in balance. So his comment on equilibrium is a comment on harmony. Dante thinks the movement of the planets is an expression of God's love. Divine, harmonious music that humans cannot hear is what keeps the universe in working order. So this divine music is what keeps humans turned toward the right objective. And in Dante's world, that's God. But you could take that metaphor today also. It just means that people are aiming toward the right objective, one objective, the same objective, a good objective. So Dante also says that, quote, love moves the sun and other stars. This is not a metaphor, actually. This is science for him. God's love for the universe is expressed in the movement of the planets. So it's a nice idea, I think, the idea that the movement of the planets is somehow an expression of divine power. Because if you think back to the time of the Romans and the Greeks, they really did think that these gods were divinities. So that the idea that the planets are godlike or associated with God somehow, that's not really a new idea. It's not really a Christian idea either. Dante's language of movement and light and circles is used not only in the context of fire and light, it's also used in some other contexts where you might not expect it. So let's look at Canto 5. Here Dante is describing fish who want to feed on something. And he says, and I quote, "As in a fish pool that is calm and clear, the fish draw close to anything that nears from outside, if it seems to be their fare. Such were the far more than 1,000 splendors I saw approaching us, and each declared, quote, here now is one who will increase our loves. And even as each shade approached, one saw, because of the bright radiance it sent forth, the joyousness with which that shade was filled." So Dante is describing a pool with fish. It's a round pool, perhaps circular, and if you throw food in the pool, the fish draw toward it. So Dante says that he is like the food thrown in the pool, and the 1,000 splendors that approach him are the fish-like spirits that want to feed on him. These are shadows or shades, they're souls of people, fish that come toward him. And yet they are also sending out bright radiance, so a kind of light. So they want food, spiritual food, they want knowledge. They want knowledge from him. So it's a pretty complex metaphor, but the natural imagery is really striking too. Fish in a pool and then flashes of light and shadow. It's a pretty image. And in this image, the fish are seeking food, just like the birds who sought food in Canto 18. So animals seeking food, this is a very natural, good image in Dante's view. That's how the world should work. So it shows the proper order of the universe. Things are doing what they should do. And it's natural that Dante should use an image like this to discuss the capturing of knowledge. So as you can see, there's a lot of images in the Paradiso that are connected images. Dante likes to compare human souls to animals moving in search of food, and he likes to compare sparks moving through the sky like souls moving toward God. He likes images of reflection and fire and shadow, and he likes science. He has passages where he goes into detail on very in-depth scientific theories. And these are pretty outdated now, but Dante was fascinated by how the world worked, and he loved to express that in his poetry. For him, the way the world worked, science, was a reflection of God's power. So what can we take away from that today? Well, I think the world is pretty miraculous too, and science is a reflection of something quite amazing, although I don't think we need God to explain it. So I just want to say thank you for listening to this lecture for the East and West Learning Connections, and I look forward to our lecture on Boethius.